Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Bill Press Pod, and welcome to this week's Reporters Roundtable. On this Friday morning, December 3rd, about 8:30 in our nation's capital, where we learned last evening the government is not going to shut down after all. The Senate joined the House in keeping the lights on at least until February, despite the fact that a handful of Senate Republicans threatened to shut things down unless President Biden dropped his vaccination mandate for businesses. In other news, the Supreme Court held oral arguments this week on the explosive subject of abortion, where six justices appeared ready to strike down Roe v. Wade. In his new book, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows reveals that Donald Trump tested positive for COVID 2 days before his first debate with Joe Biden, but now Meadows says it was all fake news. And for the moment, House Republicans stop attacking Democrats and, in the true spirit of cannibalism, start attacking each other. So much to talk about, so little time. So let's jump right in with today's panel of political reporters. Jennifer Habercorn, covering Congress for the LA Times. Hello, Jen.
Hi, Bill.
And Jeff Dufour, editor-in-chief of the National Journal. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Bill.
Welcome back, and we also hope to be joined soon by Scott Wong, who also covers Congress for The Hill. So, Jen, we ended the workday yesterday thinking, oh my God, here we go. The government's going to shut down. There's no way to avoid it this weekend. And yet, by a vote of 69 to 28, the Senate ended up passing a resolution joining the House and kicking the can down the road until February. Who blinked, Jen? What happened?
You know, I've gotten a little cynical of these things. We're praising the government for keeping the lights on with 24 hours to spare, if only for 11 weeks. But in this case, you know, Republicans were demanding a vote at a majority threshold, 50 instead of 60, on an amendment to defund the Biden administration's vaccine requirement. And, you know, this was going to be a big deal because if they picked up one Democratic vote, particularly that of Joe Manchin, they would win. But it turned out, as the day went on, a couple Republicans were absent. So it was never going to win at a 50-vote threshold. So Democrats gave them the amendment. Senator Mike Lee, the Republican from Utah, came to the floor demanding this majority threshold. And when he got it, you know, they had to move forward and accept the win, even though this was essentially designed to fail. So no one came out of this smelling like roses, and Republicans got their amendment. Of course, it lost, particularly because of those absences, and the government was funded.
Yeah. So, Jeff, who wanted this shutdown anyhow, right? I mean, Chuck Schumer didn't. Even Mitch McConnell didn't, right?
No, and even the members who were behind this, notably Mike Lee, Roger Marshall, they even said, we don't really want to shut the government down.
Uh-huh.
It appeared at the end of the day, what they really wanted was a messaging bill. They turned this into a messaging bill where they could at least go home to their constituents, save some face, and say, yeah, I hate this vaccine mandate too. I tried to vote against it, but, you know, those darn Democrats, we got to get rid of them. And the other interesting dynamic at play here was that the Republican leadership in the Senate wasn't really on board with this. John Cornyn, when we asked him about it, he said, quote, sometimes we can be our own worst enemy.
Right.
And Mike Braun, who actually has a standalone bill on this same exact thing, said, I support the underlying policy, but why do we want to shut down the government over this, which they're just going to blame us because they always do. So there was lukewarm support at best for this, even among the conference.
Right.
But I think we could also say that you got to remember, in a Congress with majorities this small, one member or a handful of members can, if they want to exercise it, can have a lot of power and can throw up these roadblocks anywhere they want, really.
Right. Well, it's interesting that the issue they chose to, some of the, that handful of Republicans chose to take their stand on was the vaccine mandate for businesses, something that Speaker Pelosi in the House said she was never going to allow Congress to do. Here is the Speaker.
How do they explain to the public that they're shutting down government because they don't want people to get vaccinated? Why don't you go ask them? This is so silly that we have people who are anti-science, anti-vaccination, saying they're going to shut down government over that. And you're asking me, what's our message?
So, Jen, this is really where they wanted to take their stand?
Yeah, and you know, Democrats seemed okay with having that fight. I mean, Chuck Schumer went to the floor back when it looked like this shutdown was going to happen and said, you know, if this happens, it's the Republicans' anti-vaccine shutdown. So both sides were clearly kind of sharpening their knives, preparing for this vaccine debate, and both sides seem to feel that it's a winning issue. Of course, you know, Republicans then have to try to navigate being pro-vaccine but anti the requirement, yeah. And Democrats have to defend the somewhat unpopular idea of the mandate. And so, yeah, it would have been tricky for both parties, but both parties also, you know, as is usually the case in these things, everyone thinks that they're right and that the public is going to agree with them. But then you add shutdown politics to it and everyone just looks like they can't, you know, tie their shoes.
Right. So Jen, you started by expressing a little skepticism about this whole song and dance. The one thing we do know for sure, right, is we're going to see the same old song and dance on February 18.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we can say that with 98% certainty. Of course, there is chatter that, you know, this is going to give leadership time to actually do appropriations bills and, you know, get out of this loop of just approving the same funding that's been approved in the past. And of course, we have to remember that, you know, Democrats are really motivated here to get out from underneath the prior spending levels, which were set during the Trump administration. And Republicans have no incentive to do that. Yes, like I said, 98% chance that we're just doing the same thing again. We're looking at a bill that funds the government for less than 3 months. But there is, of course, a small chance that Congress does actually get its act together and sets new spending levels.
All right, Bill. Yes.
Sorry, I just wanted to say there's a chance we could see something like this even before that, because a similar dynamic is happening with the National Defense Authorization.
Right. Yep.
With Marco Rubio is trying to do something similar with the China sanctions bill. So we could see this sort of obstructionism take hold even next week, maybe.
Right. Good point. Thanks,
Jeff. On another must-pass bill.
Let's jump to the Supreme Court Wednesday, a very dynamic 2 hours of oral arguments on the Mississippi law, which would ban abortions after 15 weeks. Jeff, we all have to be very careful about reading too much into oral arguments, but this time the indications are pretty strong, correct?
Yes. The writing was very much on the wall, at least among five of the justices, which way they're going on this. Of course, the backroom politics within the Supreme Court chambers is what we don't know, which is to say, will John Roberts broker some sort of a compromise that doesn't fully throw Roe out the window, or maybe just rules on a lesser issue? The fetal viability or something that doesn't completely invalidate the prior precedent.
Right. It was Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Jen, I felt, who touched on there are two, as I see it at any rate, I think most commentators did too, Adam Liptak from the New York Times, that the issue before the Supreme Court was Roe v. Wade, the issue of viability. The other issue was the integrity of the court, the legitimacy of the court, the reputation of the court. Here in her opening statement is Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
The sponsors of this bill, the House bill in Mississippi, said we're doing it because we have new justices. The Senate sponsor said we're doing it because we have new justices on the Supreme Court. Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
So, Jen, that is the point. What happens if it looks like the court is nothing but a political weather vane?
Absolutely. And I think Justice Sotomayor right there is clearly targeting John Roberts, the Chief Justice, who has the court's integrity in mind. And you could hear it in the points that he was making during the oral argument as well. I mean, if the court were to reverse Roe, it would be the biggest Supreme Court case in decades. It would capture the public's attention. It would be a huge political issue. I mean, it's hard to overstate how enormous it would be. And it would fly in the face of everything that we heard in the confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh, of Amy Coney Barrett. Both of them were asked several times whether they would respect the precedent of Roe, and either explicitly or left the impression that Roe was settled law and the importance of stare decisis, the legal term for respecting precedent. And so, you know, the liberals' best argument in the face of a 6-3 court that's heavily favored toward conservatives is the court's integrity and trying to figure out a way to preserve that.
Right. So Scott Wong joins us now from The Hill, covering Congress for The Hill.
Hey, Bill.
Hi, Scott. So what does this do about, what does this do for the reputation of Susan Collins? who insisted, right, that she trusted Brett Kavanaugh and she believed him and he would never, never vote to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Well, that is what he said in his confirmation hearings. And she came out to reporters, if you remember, there's plenty of video of it, and said that she takes Brett Kavanaugh at his word. And so if Kavanaugh and the other justices or the majority of justices go ahead and overturn Roe v. Wade through this Mississippi case, then Susan Collins will have egg on her face. I mean, so, you know, a lot of people are also saying, you know, this would be a savvy political move for Susan Collins. I mean, she's obviously from a moderate state. She understands the electorate there. And, you know, I expect if SCOTUS did overturn Roe v. Wade, then I expect Susan Collins would change her tune on that and, you know, feign some frustration, I think, with Kavanaugh and the other justices.
But Scott, she also said, Senator Collins, that this means we have to basically make it the law of the land, get Congress to act by making Roe v. Wade the law of the land. I mean, seriously, this Congress passed something that, you know, that far reaching?
Yeah, and Collins can say that, and she can join Democrats in saying that Roe v. Wade needs to be codified because it, in this Congress and in likely in many future Congresses, it never will be codified just because of the Republican filibuster in the Senate, 60 votes. I highly doubt there are 60 votes there to do that. And so she can get away with saying that she wants it codified. But the reality is, unless there's a major change or shift in the filibuster, that will never happen.
Right.
And if I could just jump in here real quick, Collins, please. In fact, came out against the bill that Democrats are pushing that would codify Roe. of course, Collins says that the bill goes further because it would prohibit all of these abortion bans that states have been enacting. And she says that she's working on a bill that would merely codify Roe There's no reason to think that Democrats are going to back down from their position to do a lesser bill at this point. So yes, Collins is saying that she wants to codify Roe, but she's not on board with the bill that the Senate is likely to vote on as soon as this month.
Yeah. And finally, on this issue, Jeff, Jen indicated earlier the possible political impact, particularly if the court goes away. It looks like it's going to go and is left up to the states. I want to read you a sentence here from the Washington Post, a couple of sentences, which may put this in context and get your comment and anyone else who cares to jump in. Quote, in 21 states where abortion bans are on the books, but Roe makes them unenforceable today, a conservative victory in Dobbs, that's the case in front of the court, could criminalize the practice immediately. Three of those states, Michigan, Arizona, and Wisconsin, were decided by single digits in the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections, and each of them has elections for governor, attorney general, and down ballot offices next year, which could be fought over whether to change abortion bans passed before most voters were born. Jeff, is this sort of the case of the dog catching the car and then not knowing what to do?
A little bit. I mean, Republicans might get a little more than they bargained for here, because for almost 50 years now, Republicans have sort of gotten a pass on this issue because they can pass these restrictions at the state level, satisfy their base, and they know the restrictions are going to get shot down by the courts. So they don't really have to answer for them. They can just then turn around and blame the courts. Well, now if they're not struck down and you have women having to go 500 miles to get an abortion, now suddenly this becomes a much bigger issue in a lot of these states. As my colleague Charlie Cook likes to say, in midterm elections, the out party tends to have all the enthusiasm because they're looking for revenge from the last election. I think as a political matter, that's all out the window if Roe is overturned. There's going to be enthusiasm all over the map with voters. I mean, turnout's already very high, but you're going to see the same kind of turnout, I think, that you saw in 2020. I also saw that 538 did a really interesting analysis of public opinion on abortion this week. And they determined that only about 29% of voters want to see Roe overturned, and only about 15% of voters want to see abortion illegal in all circumstances. So it could very well be that Republicans find themselves on the wrong side of this issue politically more than they had anticipated.
Right. I'll just add to that. I saw the latest CBS poll, 62% of Americans said, just leave Roe the way it is. Just don't touch it. Leave it the way it is. Including 60% of men and 65% of women. So Scott, I don't know what you're hearing from Republicans in the House, publicly or privately. Is this the issue they want to run on in 2022?
No, definitely not. But I do think, in talking to some Democrats actually just last night, they're saying that this is going to be a quote, monumental mobilizer for both parties, similar to what Jeff said. It's hard to figure out who has the edge. I guess you could say Democrats would have the edge because of the polls. But I think also Republicans would have a strong political argument if Roe v. Wade is overturned, or if these justices uphold the Mississippi law. Because Republicans can say, well, look what happens when you elect us and give us control of the levers of power. We can install conservative justices. We can have generational impact on cases like Roe v. Wade. That certainly will mobilize their base and get their voters excited. And so I think it remains to be seen. And I also think the headwinds are so significant for Democrats, certainly in the House, which where I cover, that it's hard to see how exactly this case will fit in with the larger election picture in 2022.
Right. And before we take a break, so President Biden was out at the NIH yesterday announcing the latest steps that the administration wants to take in face of the Omicron variant. Jen, it looks like President Biden, like President Trump before him, the whole presidency is being defined by how they respond to a pandemic. What's the sort of rating, or what's the take on the administration's response to Omicron?
Well, I think the administration's biggest problem is that they are just dealing with a public that is so fatigued on COVID. Even those Democrats who support the president are just, I mean, everyone's sick of it, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's going to be a real challenge in the weeks ahead, particularly if we're, you know, as you mentioned, the requirement that folks have to get a COVID test before flying, if there are further restrictions on air travel. And, you know, I don't want to mention the lockdown word, but if there's any hint that that we're moving in that direction again, it's going to be a challenge. And even the best Build Back Better bill is not going to overpower COVID fatigue.
Right. Jeff, it's like every time we think we're getting out of this, then something else comes along, right? I mean, this is the new reality.
Yeah. And I forget what the exact quote was, but Dr. Fauci this weekend said something like, we're just going to have to learn to live with this, at least in the short term, I think. We've also seen increased travel restrictions, and then we've got masks on public transit through March. I think it's certainly throughout the winter, this is going to be the new reality. I think people's patience will sort of be maintained as long as schools aren't affected again. If schools are affected again, all bets are off. And then it becomes a real political problem.
Yeah, COVID fatigue, I think, is the word, in fact. Okay, with today's panel, Jennifer Habercorn from the LA Times, Scott Wong from The Hill, Jeff Dufour from the National Journal. Let's take a quick break on the Bill Press Pod, and we'll be right back and pick up with some of the other news in Congress about all the infighting in Congress and about the former chief of staff's new book. That's next on the Bill Press Pod. And today's roundtable is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers, America's teachers, men and women from grade school, preschool, all the way up through higher education, members of the AFT under the leadership of President Randy Weingarten. They are on the front lines, particularly in this fight against COVID in the nation's schools, keeping our kids and their parents safe. Tough job. They've risen to the occasion. We salute the members of the AFT. Thank them for doing the Lord's work every day in the classroom, and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle.
Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. Today's roundtable. Jennifer Haberkorn joining us from the LA Times, Scott Wong from The Hill, and Jeff Dufour, editor-in-chief of the National Journal. Well, Mark Meadows, former chief of staff, says he doesn't want to talk to the select committee in the House investigating January 6th, but he will talk to anybody who will buy his book. And one of the things that Mark Meadows says in his book is that President Trump actually tested positive for COVID 2 days before his first debate with Joe Biden. Immediately, the president, former president, says, that's not true. Mark Meadows is guilty of fake news. And then Mark Meadows, standing up for himself, no, not quite, responds this way.
Well, the president's right. It's fake news.
So, Jen, real question of a backbone there on the part of Mark Meadows, right?
You know, I'm not sure if it was just a reflex when you hear something you don't like to say it's fake news, but then when you're the source for it, I don't know how you can, how that manages. But yeah, clearly, I mean, he had to have known that the former president would not want this out when he wrote it. So I don't know what the motivation there was. Another mystifying moment.
Yeah, sell more books, Jen. He wanted to sell more books.
I think that may be it. But my question, Jeff, is didn't Mark Meadows, if he knew this, and he did know it, and particularly did the White House doctor, Sean Connolly, not have an obligation, a duty to inform the public if the president of the United States tests positive for COVID and then exposes people around him, including one of our colleagues, Michael Scheer, who may or may not have gotten the pandemic from Donald Trump, possibly. Wasn't there an obligation to inform the public?
Yeah, the lack of transparency over Trump's health was really something. There's still that unannounced visit to Walter Reed before he got COVID, which was never explained. We think it might have been a colonoscopy. Nobody's quite sure. And the timeline around Trump's positive test was really something. He tests positive. The next day, he's got an event for military families at the White House.
Right.
During which no one wears a mask. And Trump even jokes about it and tells people, no, you don't have to wear masks here. Then he goes to the debate, refuses to take a test because he says he's gotten there too late for the test to be accurate. Is on the stage with Joe Biden. I mean, and as you said, he's on Air Force One gaggling with reporters. And then suggests after the fact, knowing he got a positive test, suggests after the fact that maybe it was Hope Hicks who gave him the virus when Hope Hicks tested positive. I mean, the whole thing is just astounding. It's not surprising at this point, but it's nevertheless remains astounding.
Well, Scott, now this gets into the purview of the January 6th Select Committee, which you've been covering. The question is, if Mark Meadows refuses to testify but is willing to publish a book, doesn't that kind of undercut his claim of executive privilege?
Well, that was his argument earlier, that they were hiding behind executive privilege, as others close to Trump tried to do and failed to do because they were held in contempt of Congress and referred to the Justice Department. I think once Mark Meadows saw that, saw Steve Bannon and others being referred to the Justice Department, he changed his mind. And the latest reporting is that he is now cooperating with the January 6th panel, which, you know, basically thwarts a contempt of Congress vote on the House floor. But the real question is when he shows up and when he does come before and testify before that committee, likely in a closed door session, you know, how cooperative will he be? You know, showing up is one thing. We've seen Jeffrey Clark a former Trump DOJ official, show up but not answer any questions. So the real question is, Meadows and others close to Meadows are we understand, going to participate, going to cooperate, so they say, but what does cooperation really look like?
Right. While we're in the Congress, though, Jen, your territory as well, we saw this week the infighting, particularly among Republican women in Congress. Lauren Boebert, well, she went after first Ilhan Omar, of course. In fact, let's listen to this. Is Lauren Boebert's in front of a group back in her district talking about how she was not afraid to get in the elevator with Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who happens to be a Muslim.
I was getting into an elevator with one of my staffers. I looked to my left, and there she is, Ilhan Omar. Oops. And I said, well, she doesn't have a backpack. We should be fine.
Kevin McCarthy, going to take any action here, Jen?
No, and I don't. I think we're seeing the continuation of a trend in which Republican leadership, I should say, Reagan-file Republicans say things against fellow members of Congress. In one case, Paul Gosar posted anime of killing Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and going after Joe Biden, and then not doing anything. And it's, you know, there's no reason to think that this is going to stop. If anything, it's escalating. I feel like we're seeing it more and more often and more intensity. And I think it's going to be a real issue, particularly if Republicans do take the majority next year, as many people think that they will. If we continue to see members going after other members like this, it's really a troubling trend.
So Republicans going after Democrats is maybe not that surprising, but then you had this pretty nasty exchange, Scott, between Marjorie Taylor Greene and Nancy Mace from South Carolina, where Nancy Mace even said that Marjorie Taylor Greene was batshit crazy. Again, what's striking to me is that Kevin McCarthy just basically lets us all go on while he's sitting on the sidelines. Scott, what's going on?
Well, you know, Democrats and I think many Republicans privately will say McCarthy has lost control of his GOP conference. And the reason he has apparently lost control is because he needs both wings of that conference, the far right, you know, ultra conservative pro-Trump wing, as well as many of the more moderate members in the center, in order to become Speaker of the House. That's been his, you know, lifelong ambition. He's been at it for 10 years in leadership. You remember, Bill, back in 2015, we've discussed this many times, when the Freedom Caucus, led at that time, I think, by Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan,
right,
thwarted McCarthy's efforts to become Speaker after John Boehner. And so he's been sitting back, you know, quietly toiling in the hopes of reclaiming that speaker's gavel in 2022-2023. And so he needs both of those wings of the party in order to become speaker. He's trying to make peace between them. And he knows that if he throws Gosar under the bus and holds him accountable, if he goes after Lauren Boebert, all hell is going to break loose, and his chances to become speaker become very, very slim at that point, because he'll need a lot of those people in order to win 218 votes on the floor.
Okay, so before we wrap up, Jeff, give us a picture, a look at the national political scene. We saw this week Stacey Abrams jump back in, running for governor in Georgia. Last week, Beto O'Rourke running for governor in Texas. New life among the Democratic Party, or just running a couple of former losers? What's going on?
Well, it is do or die for them, because you lose one big race like that and you can shrug it off, lose two big races like that and then you are a political loser. But I've really found, ever since Glenn Youngkin's win in Virginia, I've found the dynamic in governor's races really, really interesting. Youngkin was able to keep the Virginia race mostly local. Now, I have to wonder, though, if Youngkin were running statewide for Senate, let's say, instead of governor, how much does that change the dynamic? I think voters now are a little bit more savvy. They know that a vote for a Republican for Senate is a vote for Mitch McConnell, effectively. A vote for a Democrat is a vote for Chuck Schumer. I see the same thing maybe with Larry Hogan in Maryland. Should he try to run? Does he get the same traction as a Senate candidate? And then flip it around to Democrats. Is there a path for Stacey Abrams or Beto O'Rourke in a governor's race if they keep things as local as possible? I'm skeptical because, number one, they're already national figures, and they're already very well defined. And secondly, I'm skeptical because of the national mood and the national political fundamentals. I think Biden's approvals have to tick up a little bit. Democrats overall, their approvals have to tick up a little bit and give them a little bit of an opening to make a move.
But, you know, it's interesting how many topics that we've touched on this morning are going to carry over and have an impact on the 2022 midterm elections. It's really shaping up almost every day. And a lot to cover, and you guys have done a great job doing so far. Thank you so much, Jen Habercorn, Scott Wong, and Jeff Dufour. We won't let you go, though, without sharing with us what your favorite story of the week was, the one thing that you saw that made you stop for a couple of seconds and think a little bit more about it. Jennifer, let's start with you.
So my story comes from one of my colleagues at the Los Angeles Times, Sammy Roth. It's part of a series that we're doing on looking back at 2021. As you can imagine, some of it is pretty dire. Some of it is hopeful. But in particular, this is on climate. The headline is "The American West Went Through Climate Hell in 2021, But There's Still Hope," as part of a really good series.
In terms of 2021 and climate change, you said, or
that's right.
Yeah, particularly in the West, right, with all the flooding and wildfires and everything else. Good piece, and thanks, Jen, so much for joining us today. Jeff Dufour, what caught your attention?
I am not, Bill, a big college football guy. Number one, because I grew up in the Northeast, where we are a little bit more interested in college basketball than college football. And number two, because college football is a corrupt, monopolistic cartel, which is why it warms my heart so much to see none other than the University of Cincinnati needing one more win this weekend to break into the college football playoff. This would be, if I'm not mistaken, the first team to make the playoff not from one of the Big Five power conferences.
Boy, I don't follow it at all, but I was just going to say, I've never heard of University of Cincinnati in the top ranks, right?
Exactly. They are currently ranked third, ahead of a lot of the big boys, and they should be able to make the playoff. Which means, of course, that this is not going to have a happy ending. What's going to happen is next year is the cartel is going to find another way to squeeze out these schools from any other conferences as they put a further hold on their monopoly.
Well, think of it this way, Jeff. We're talking about impacts on 2022. You know, Cincinnati wins. Just think what that will do for Tim Ryan's Senate race in Ohio, right?
There you go. There's a populist message there.
And he'll take advantage of it for sure. Scott Wong, help us out with your favorite story.
All right. I'll give it a shot here. I got some great behind the scenes details for you, Bill.
Good.
Dean Phillips, I chatted with him yesterday at the Capitol. He was one of a handful of Minnesota Democrats who flew back on Air Force One with President Biden after his visit to the Minneapolis area. Flew back to D.C., 90 minutes in the cabin with him in a little conference room.
Whoa.
He said that Biden entered the room. He didn't even sit down in one of the chairs. He got down on his knee and got at the level of all the lawmakers that were sitting there they talked about a lot of things, policy, build back better. Biden called family members of the lawmakers in the room. He recorded videos for somebody who was battling an illness. And in Dean Phillips' words, Biden displayed his superpower, which is his empathy and compassion, again, in Phillips' words, which was devoid in the last president. And so, you know, Phillip's takeaway from that 90-minute meeting, he said it was the longest time he's ever been with the president and in that intimate setting. And he said he'd like to see Biden get out into the country more, use his bully pulpit, but also to show off that strength of his, which is connecting with people, with everyday Americans in that very human way that Phillip said he saw up close earlier this week. And so Phillips is putting that pressure on the administration. A number of other Democrats on Capitol Hill want to see Biden get out into the country more, do these events, you know, day after day, and you know, display some of his strengths. They think that will be a real winner for Democrats in 2022.
That is a very interesting story. And boy, I could not agree more. I've told several friends, we don't see the Joe Biden that I knew in the Senate or even as vice president, that we don't see that same Joe Biden now that he's in the White House. He's so sort of locked down by his handlers, I think. We don't see the human side of Biden. So I think Phillips is right, and I hope he's successful in convincing Ron Klain and others to let Joe be Joe. There's a risk in letting Joe be Joe, but at the same time, it's helpful for people to see his personality. Now, my favorite story of the week, well, you know, it's just a story. I don't think that got as much attention as it deserved because it says a lot about the new power of workers in this country. And I'm talking about a decision by the National Labor Relations Board this week. You may remember back in April, there was a big election, got a lot of attention by workers at the Amazon plant in Bessemer, Alabama. The union, Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, wanted to organize, form a union for the workers at that Amazon warehouse down in Bessemer, Alabama. Even President Biden supported the workers. But when the election was held, it lost. I mean, the union lost like big time bad. Well, they appealed to the National Labor Relations Board and said that Amazon unfairly influenced the outcome of that election, put too much pressure on the workers to vote against it. And surprise, surprise, the National Labor Relations Board voted this week, the regional board voted this week to agree with the union and allow a new election. Haven't given the date yet, but they're going to redo the election, a total remake redo of that election, which is stunning. First time I ever remember that happening. And I think it speaks to two things. One, that as one labor union president told me this week, the Biden administration is the most pro-union presidency ever, better than Bill Clinton and even Barack Obama. And two, it speaks to, again, the new power of workers in this post-pandemic economy. They're the ones who are calling the shots, and they had a big win down in Alabama. And maybe next time the workers will make the right decision under the right terms and form a union. After all, Amazon is worth $1.9 trillion. They can afford to pay their workers a livable wage. And that's it for today's Roundtable, today's podcast. Thank you so much to our great panelists, Jennifer Habercorn from the LA Times, Scott Wong from The Hill, and Jeff Dufour from The National Journal. And thanks to all of you, as always, for listening. Remember, if you haven't yet subscribed, please do so. Just go to wherever you listen to your podcast, pull up the Bill Press Pod, and subscribe. And tell your friends to do the same, or else they're missing out with a great podcast twice a week. Meanwhile, so take care of yourselves over the weekend. Wear that mask, practice your social distancing. We're not out of the woods yet, but we'll be looking for you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.